industry. He's a physicist. I can't believe that a scientist sitting in his ivory tower can know so much about the detailed realities of the shop floor. And then the idea of scientist came up again when Lou and Ralph were arguing about the usefulness of classifying data. And I myself supplied the answer. How does one go about revealing the intrinsic order? Lou asked it as if it were a rhetorical question, as if the obvious answer was that it's impossible. But scientists do reveal the intrinsic order of things, and Jonah is a scientist. Somewhere in the scientific method lies the answer for the needed management techniques. It's obvious, but what can I do? I can't read a book in physics. I don't know enough mathematics to get through even the first page. But maybe I don't need it. Jonah stressed that he wasn't asking me to develop the methods, just to determine clearly what they should be. Maybe popular science books would be sufficient. At least I should give it a try. I should go to the library and start digging. The first modern physicist was Newton, and that's probably the place to start. I'm sitting in my office, my feet up on the desk and staring blankly into the room. The entire morning, I got only two calls, both from Johnny Johns. First, he called to inform me that the deal with the French is signed. He was very proud of the fact that he negotiated a better deal than expected. In return for the flexibility and immediacy of our response to their future requests, he succeeded in squeezing slightly higher prices. The second time, he wanted to know if he could approach our domestic clients with the same concept. That is, to shoot for a long-term contract where only the overall yearly quantities are fixed, and we promise 3 weeks' delivery for any specific request. I assured him that we don't have any problem responding and encouraged him to go ahead. He's excited. I'm far from it. Everybody is busy. Launching this huge new deal has made them really busy. I'm the only one who has nothing to do. I feel redundant. Where are the days of the telephone ringing off the hook, when I had to run from one important issue to the other, when there were not enough hours in the day? All those calls and meetings were firefighting, I remind myself. No fires, no fighting. Now, everything is running smoothly. Almost too smoothly. Actually, what bothers me is that I know what I should be doing. I need to guarantee that the current situation will continue, that things are thought out in advance so fires will not break out. But this means finding the answer to Jonah's question. I stand up and leave. On my way out, I say to Fran, in the unlikely event that anyone needs me, I'll be at the public library.
Enough for today. Julie, join me for a cup of tea?
Good idea. I'll be with you in a minute.
You're really into it.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
What can be so fascinating about ancient Greek philosophy?
It's not what you think. These dialogues of Socrates are really interesting.
If you say so.
Alex, your perceptions are all wrong. It's not at all like what you think.
So, what is it?
Well, it's hard to explain. Why don't you try to read them yourself?
Maybe one day I will. But for the moment, I have enough reading to do.
Did you find what you're looking for?
Not exactly. Reading popular science books doesn't lead you directly to management techniques. But I've started to see something interesting.
Yes?
It's how physicists approach a subject. It's so vastly different from what we do in business. They don't start by collecting as much data as possible. On the contrary, they start with one phenomenon, some fact of life, almost randomly chosen, and then they raise a hypothesis, a speculation of a plausible cause for the existence of that fact. And here's the interesting part. It all seems to be based on one key relationship. If, then.
Keep going.
What they actually do is to derive the unavoidable results logically from their hypothesis. They say, if the hypothesis is right, then, logically, another fact must also exist. With these logical derivations, they open up a whole spectrum of other effects. Of course, the major effort is to verify whether or not the predicted effects do exist. As more and more predictions are verified, it becomes more obvious that the underlying hypothesis is correct. To read, for example, how Newton did it for the law of gravity is fascinating.
Why?
Things start to be connected to each other. Things that we never thought were related start to be strongly connected to each other. One single common cause is the reason for a very large spectrum of different effects. You know, Julie, it's like order is built out of chaos. What can be more beautiful than that?
Do you know what you have just described? The Socratic dialogues. They're done in exactly the same way, through exactly the same relationship. If, then. Maybe the only difference is that the facts don't concern material, but human behavior.
Interesting. Very interesting. Come to think about it, my field, management, involves both material and people behavior. If the same method can be used for each, then it's probably the basis for Jonah's techniques.
You're probably right. But if you are, then I'm willing to bet that when Jonah starts to teach you those techniques, you'll find that they are much more than techniques. They must be thinking processes. Where do we take it from here?
I don't know. Frankly, I don't think that all this reading really gets me any closer to answering Jonah's question. Remember what he said? I'm not asking you to develop the management techniques, only to determine what they should be. I'm afraid I'm trying to jump to the next step, to develop them. Determining the management techniques must come from the need itself, from examining how I currently operate, and then trying to find out how I should operate.
Chapter 39.
Any messages?
Yes, from Bill Peach. He wants to talk to you.
Hey, Bill, what's up?
I just received your numbers from last month. Congratulations, Hotshot. You've definitely made your point. I've never seen anything even remotely close to this.
Thank you. By the way, what are the results at Hilton Smythe's plant?
You must twist the dagger, huh? Well, as you predicted, Hilton is not doing too well. His indicators continue to improve, but his bottom line continues to sink into the red.
I told you that those indicators are based on local optima and that they have nothing to do with the global picture.
I know. As a matter of fact, I think that I knew it all along, but I guess an old mule like me just needs to see the proof in black and red. Well, I think that I've finally seen it.
It's about time. So what's next?
Well, this is why I called you, Alex. I spent the entire day yesterday with Nathan Frost, and it seems that he's in agreement with you, but I can't understand what he's talking about. Well, there was a time that I thought I understood all this mumbo-jumbo of cost of goods sold and variances, but after yesterday, it's obvious that I don't. I need someone who can explain it to me in straight terms, someone like you. You do understand all this, don't you?
I think I do. Actually, it's very simple. It's all a matter of...
No. Not on the phone. Besides, you have to come here anyway. Only 1 month left, and you should get familiar with the details of your new job.
Tomorrow morning, okay?
No problem. And Alex, you have to explain to me what you've done to Johnny Johns. He goes around claiming that we can make a lot of money if we sell below what it cost us to produce, and that is pure baloney.
See you tomorrow. Bill Peach abandoning his precious indicators? This is something I have to tell everyone. They'll never believe it. I go to Donovan's office, but he's not there, nor is Stacy. They must be on the floor. I ask Fran to locate them. In the meantime, I'm going to Lou to tell him the news. Stacy reaches me there.
Hey, boss. We have some problems here. Can we come in half an hour?
No rush. It's not so important. Take your time.
I don't agree. I'm afraid that it is important.
What are you talking about?
It probably has started. Bob and I will be in your office in half an hour, okay?
Okay. Lou, do you know what's going on?
No, unless, of course, you're referring to the fact that Stacy and Bob have been busy for the last week playing expediters.
They are?
To make a long story short, already 12 work centers are on unplanned overtime.
The situation is out of control. Yesterday, one order was not shipped on time. Today, three more will be delayed for sure. According to Ralph, we're going downhill from there. He claims that before the end of the month, we'll miss the shipping dates on about 20% of our orders, and not by just 1 or 2 days.
I'm looking at my phone. It won't take more than a few days, and this monster will ring off the hook with furious complaints. It's one thing to be consistently bad. The clients are used to it, and they protect themselves by stocks or time buffers. But now we've spoiled them. They are already used to our good performance. This is much worse than I've imagined. It might ruin the plant. How did it happen? Where did I go astray? How come?
I told you. Order number 49318 is stuck because of...
No, Bob. It's not the details that are important. We should look for the core problem. Alex, I think that we simply accepted more orders than we can process.
That's obvious, but how come? I thought we checked that the bottlenecks have enough capacity. We also checked your 7 other problematic work centers. Did we make a mistake in the calculations?
Probably.
Not likely. We checked and double-checked it.
So?
So I don't know, but it doesn't matter. We have to do something now and fast.
Yes, but what? As long as we don't know what caused the situation, the best we can do is to throw punches in all directions. That was our old mode of operation. I had hoped that we had learned better. I accept their lack of response as agreement. Let's call Lou and Ralph and move into the conference room. We must put our heads together to figure out what's really going on.
Let's get the facts straight. Bob, are you convinced that you need to keep using so much overtime?
The efforts of the last few days have convinced me that even with overtime, we're going to miss due dates.
I see. Ralph, are you convinced that at the end of the month, in spite of the overtime, we are going to be late on many orders?
If we don't find a smart way to solve this mess, without a doubt. I can't tell you the dollar amount. That depends on Bob and Stacy's decisions of how much overtime to use and which orders to expedite. But it's in the neighborhood of over $1 million.
That's bad. I'll have to redo my forecast.
That is the major damage that he sees? Redo the forecast? Can we address the real issue? Listen again to what you're saying. I don't see a major problem. It's obvious that we tried to swallow more than we can chew. What we have to do is to determine by how much and then compensate. It's as simple as that. Lou nods his head in approval. Bob, Ralph, and Stacy continue to look at me with poker faces. They even look offended. There must be something wrong in what I've said, but I can't see what. Ralph, by how much are our bottlenecks overloaded?
They're not overloaded.
No problem there, so let...
He didn't say that.
I don't understand. If the bottlenecks aren't overloaded, then...
From time to time, the bottlenecks are starved. Then the work comes to them in a big wave.
And then we don't have a choice but to go into overtime. That's the case all over the plant. It looks like the bottlenecks are moving all the time.
What can we do now?
If it were as easy as determining some overloads, don't you think we would easily solve it?
She's right. I should have more confidence in them. My apologies.
Look, we can't handle it by shuffling priorities and going into overtime. We've already tried that for several days. It might help save some specific orders, but it throws the entire plant into chaos, and then many more orders are in trouble.
Yes. Brute force seems to push us more and more into the spiral. That's why we asked for this meeting.
I accept their criticism. Okay, fellows, it's obvious that we have to approach it systematically. Anyone get an idea where to begin?
Maybe we should start by examining a situation where we have one bottleneck.
What's the point? We now have the opposite. We are facing many traveling bottlenecks.
I don't have any other suggestion, nor does anyone else. I decide to gamble on Ralph's hunch. It worked in the past. Please proceed. He goes to the board and takes the eraser.
Well, at least don't erase the 5 steps.
Well, they don't seem to help us much. Identify the system's constraints. Well, that's not the problem now. The problem is that the bottlenecks are moving all over the place.
Nevertheless, he puts the eraser down and turns to the flip chart. He draws a row of circles.
Suppose that each circle represents a work center. The tasks are flowing from the left to the right. Now let's suppose that this one is a bottleneck.
And he marks one of the middle circles with a big X.
Very nice. Now what?
Now let's introduce Murphy into the picture. Suppose that Murphy hits directly on the bottleneck.
Then the only thing left to do is to curse wholeheartedly. Throughput is lost.
Correct. But what happens when Murphy hits anywhere before the bottleneck? In such a case, the stream of tasks to the bottleneck is temporarily stopped, and the bottleneck is starved. Isn't this our case?
Not at all. We never operated that way. We always make sure that some inventory accumulates in front of the bottleneck. So when an upstream resource goes down for some time, the bottleneck can continue to work. As a matter of fact, Ralph, we had so much inventory there that we had to choke the material release to the floor. Come on, that's exactly what you're doing on your computers. Why do we have to regurgitate what we all know by heart?
I just wondered if we really know how much inventory we should allow to accumulate in front of the bottlenecks.
Bob, he has a point.
Of course I have. We wanted 3 days' inventory in front of each bottleneck. I started with releasing material 2 weeks before it was due at the bottleneck. Then it turned out that that's too much, so I cut it to 1 week, and everything was okay. Now it's not okay.
So increase it back.
I can't. It will increase our lead time beyond what we currently promise.
What's the difference? In any event, we're sliding on our promises.
Wait. Before we do anything drastic, I want to understand better. Ralph, let's go back to your picture. As Bob pointed out, we do hold some stock in front of the bottleneck. Now, let's suppose that Murphy hits somewhere before the bottleneck. Then what?
Then the flow of parts to the bottleneck stops, but the bottleneck, using the stock that accumulated right in front of it, continues to work. Of course, that eats into the stock, and so if we don't build enough stock to start with, the bottleneck might go down.
Something doesn't match. According to what you just said, we have to guarantee the uninterrupted work of the bottleneck by building stock that will last more than the time to overcome Murphy on the upstream resource.
Correct.
Don't you see that it can't be the explanation?
Why?
Ralph doesn't get it, and neither do I.
Because the time to overcome a problem upstream did not change. We haven't faced any major catastrophes lately, so if the stock was sufficient to protect the bottlenecks before, it must be sufficient now as well. No, Ralph, it's not a matter of insufficient stocks. It's simply new wandering bottlenecks.
I guess you're right.
Maybe Ralph is convinced by Stacy's argument, but I'm not. I think that Ralph might be right after all. We just have to carry his line of thought a little further. We said that when one of the upstream resources goes down, the bottleneck starts to eat into its stock. Once the problem is corrected, what do all the upstream resources have to do? Remember, if there's one thing that we can be sure of, it's that Murphy will strike again.
All upstream resources now have to rebuild the inventory in front of the bottleneck before Murphy hits again. But what's the problem? We released enough material for them.
It's not the material that concerns me. It's the capacity. You see, when the problem that caused the stoppage is overcome, the upstream resources not only have to supply the current consumption of the bottleneck, at the same time, they have to rebuild the inventory.
That's right. That means that there are times when the non-bottlenecks must have more capacity than the bottlenecks. Now I understand. The fact that we have bottlenecks and non-bottlenecks is not because we designed the plant very poorly. It's a must. If the upstream resources don't have spare capacity, we won't be able to utilize even one single resource to the maximum. Starvation will preclude it.
Yes, but now the question is, how much spare capacity do we need?
No, that's not the question. Just as your previous question, how much inventory do we need, is not the real question either.
I see. It's a trade-off. The more inventory we allow before the bottleneck, the more time is available for upstream resources to catch up. And so, on average, they need less spare capacity. The more inventory, the less spare capacity, and vice versa.
Okay, now it's clear what's happening. The new orders have changed the balance. We took more orders, which by themselves didn't turn any resource into a new bottleneck, but they did drastically reduce the amount of spare capacity on the non-bottlenecks, and we didn't compensate with increased inventory in front of the bottleneck.
Everybody agrees. As usual, when the answer finally emerges, it's plain common sense. Okay, Bob, what do you think you should do now? He takes his time. We wait. Finally, he turns to Ralph.
We have outstanding promises for very short delivery times on only a small percent of our order intake. Can you identify those orders on an ongoing basis?
No problem.
Okay. For those orders, continue to release material 1 week in advance. For all others, increase it to 2 weeks, and let's hope that'll be enough. Now, we have to rebuild the inventory in front of the bottlenecks and in front of assembly. Stacy, take all the necessary steps to put the plant, and I mean all the non-bottlenecks, to work throughout the weekend. Don't accept any excuses. It's an emergency. Now, I'll notify sales that until further notice, they should not promise any delivery in less than 4 weeks from receipt of the order. It'll jeopardize their new campaign, but that's life.
Right in front of our eyes, the baton has been passed. It's obvious who's the boss now. I feel proud and jealous at the same time.
Bob has taken over very nicely. At least this front is covered.
Yes, but I hate to put him in a position where his first independent actions are so negative.
Negative? What do you mean by negative?
Lou, all the actions he's forced to take are leading in the wrong direction. Of course, he doesn't have any choice. The alternative is much worse.
Alex, but I'm probably thicker than usual today, but I really don't understand. What do you mean by leading in the wrong direction?
Don't you see? What's the unavoidable result of telling sales that they should quote 4 weeks' delivery? Remember, just 2 weeks ago, we went out of our way to persuade them to quote 2 weeks. They didn't have much confidence then. Now it'll cause them to drop the entire sales campaign.
What else can we do?
Probably nothing. But this doesn't change the end result. Future throughput is down.
I see. On top of it, overtime is up significantly. Putting the plant to work on the weekend will consume the entire overtime budget for the quarter.
Forget the budget. When Bob has to report it, I'll be the divisional president. The increased overtime is increasing operating expense. The point is that throughput will be down, operating expense will be up, and increasing the buffers means that inventory will be up. Everything's moving in the opposite direction of what it should.
Yep.
Somewhere, I've made a mistake. A mistake that now is causing us to pull back. You know, Lou, we still don't know what we're doing. Our ability to see what's in front of us resembles that of moles. We're reacting rather than planning.
But you've got to agree that we're reacting much better than before.
That's not a real comfort, Lou. We're also moving much faster than before. I feel as if I'm driving, looking only in the rearview mirror. And then, when it's almost too late, we make last-minute course corrections. It's not good enough. It's definitely not good enough.
Chapter 40.
I'm driving back from headquarters with Lou. We've been doing this every day for the last 2 weeks. We are not in one might call a cheerful mood. Now we know every little detail of what's going on in the division, and the picture doesn't look good at all. The only bright spot is my plant. No, I should get used to the fact that it's Donovan's plant. And it's not a bright spot. That's a gross understatement. It's the real savior. Donovan succeeded in getting everything under control before the clients had any reason to complain. It will take him some time to regain the confidence of our salespeople, but with me pressing from the other side, it will not take long before it'll be okay. This plant is so good that Lou and I were led astray for some time. The reports on the division gave us the impression that the situation is quite good. Only when we went through the elaborate work of separating out Donovan's plant was the real picture exposed, and it's not pretty. It's actually quite disastrous. Lou, I think we did the exact thing that we knew we shouldn't do.
What are you talking about? We haven't done anything.
We have gathered data. Lots of data.
Yes, and there's a problem with the data. Frankly, I've never seen such a sloppy place. Every report is missing at least backup details. You know what I found today? They don't even have a report on late receivables. The information is there, but can you believe it's scattered in at least 3 different places? How can they operate this way?
Lou, you're missing the point.
Am I? Do you know that with proper attention we can reduce the open receivables by at least 4 days?
And that will save the division.
No, but it will help.
Will it? Do you really believe it will help? Look, Lou, what have we learned? What did you yourself say when you asked for the job? Do you still remember?
I don't know what you're talking about. Don't you want me to correct things which are obviously wrong?
How am I going to explain it to him? Lou, suppose that you do succeed in collecting 4 days out of the open receivables. By how much will throughput, inventory, and operating expense be improved?
They'll all be slightly improved, but the major impact will be on cash. You shouldn't sneeze at 4 days' cash. Besides, improving the division requires many small steps. If everyone does his share, together we can lift it.
I drive silently. What Lou said makes sense, but somehow I know that he's wrong. Dead wrong. Lou, help me here. I know that improving the division will require many small improvements, but...
But what? Alex, you are too impatient. You know what they say, Rome was not built in a day.
We don't have hundreds of years. Lou is right. I am impatient. But shouldn't I be? Did we save our plant by being patient? And then I see it. Yes, many small actions are needed, but that doesn't mean that we can afford to be satisfied with actions that improve the situation. We must carefully choose which ones to concentrate on, otherwise. Lou, let me ask you, how much time will it take you to change, for internal purposes only, the way that we evaluate inventory?
The mechanical work is not a real problem. That won't take more than a few days. But if you're referring to the work it'll take to explain the ramifications, to explain to managers how this affects their day-to-day decisions, that's a different story. With concentrated effort, I'd say it'll take weeks.
Now I'm on solid ground. What do you think is the impact of the way we currently evaluate inventory on the levels of finished stocks that the division currently holds?
Significant.
How significant? Can you give me a number?
I'm afraid not. Not even a meaningful evaluation.
Well, let's try and do it together. Have you noticed the increase in finished goods that the division is holding?
Yes, I have. But why are you surprised? It's exactly what should be expected. Sales are down, and the pressure to show profits is up. So they build finished goods inventory to generate fictitious inventory profits. I see what you mean. We can take the increase in finished goods as an indicator of the impact of the way we value inventory. Wow, it's about 70 days.
Lovely. Compare it to your 4 days of receivables. On what should you work? Moreover, what is the impact on throughput?
I don't see any. I see very clearly the impact on cash, on inventory, and on operating expense, but not on throughput.
Don't you? What was the reason that they gave us for not introducing the new models? Can you recall?
Yes. They are convinced that introducing the new models will force them to declare all the old ones they're holding in stock as obsolete. That would cause a major blow to the bottom line.
So, we continue to offer the old stuff rather than the new. We continue to lose market share, but it's better than biting the bullet of write-offs. Do you understand now the impact it has on throughput?
Yes, I do. You are right. But, Alex, you know what? With some extra effort, I think that I can handle them both. I can work on the problem of the way we value inventory, and at the same time arrange for more attention to the receivables.
He still doesn't get it, but now I think I know how to handle it. What about the plant indicators?
Oh, that's a real Pandora's box.
What's the damage there? Slightly bigger than 4 days? And what about the fact that sales continue to judge opportunities according to the formal product cost and desirable margins? Or even worse, that they will look for anything that they can sell above variable cost. What's the damage there? And what about the transfer prices between us and the other divisions? That's a real killer. Do you want more?
Stop, stop. You made your point. I guess I was inclined to deal with the open receivables issue. Just because there I know what to do, while in all the others...
Afraid?
Well, frankly, yes.
So am I. Where do we start? Where do we continue? On what should we concentrate first? On what second? It's overwhelming.
We need a process, that's obvious. It's too bad that the 5-step process that we developed turned out to be false. No, wait a minute, Alex. That's not the case. At the end, the problem was not wandering bottlenecks. It was insufficient protection for the existing bottlenecks. Maybe we can use that 5-step process.
I don't see how, but it's worthwhile to check it. Should we head to the plant and give it a try?
Certainly. I'll have to make some phone calls, but it's no problem.
No. I have some commitments for tonight.
You're right. It's very important, but not urgent. It can wait for tomorrow.
Lou reads from the board.
Identify the system's constraints. Do we accept it as the first step?
I don't know. Let's examine the logic that brought us to write it. Do you remember what it was?
Roughly. It was something about the fact that we adopted throughput as the number one measurement.
I'm afraid that roughly is not good enough. At least not at such an early stage in our analysis. Let's try again from first principles.
I'm all for it. But what do you call first principles?
I don't know. Something basic that we accept without hesitation.
Fine. I have one for you. Every organization was built for a purpose. We haven't built any organization just for the sake of its mere existence.
Correct. Even though I know some people in some organizations who seem to forget it.
Washington, you mean?
Well, that too. I was thinking about corporate, but never mind. Let's keep going. Another basic fact is that any organization is composed of more than one person. Otherwise, it's not an organization.
Correct. But I don't see the point in all this. I can give you many more correct statements about organizations in general.
Yeah, you probably can, but look at the conclusion that we can derive already. If any organization was built for a purpose, and any organization is comprised of more than one person, then we must conclude that the purpose of the organization requires the synchronized efforts of more than one person.
That makes sense. Otherwise, we wouldn't need to create an organization. The efforts of individuals would suffice. So?
If we need synchronized efforts, then the contribution of any single person to the organization's purpose is strongly dependent upon the performance of others.
Yes, that's obvious. Obvious to everybody except for our measurement system.
Even though I wholeheartedly agree, I ignore his last comment. If synchronized efforts are required, and the contribution of one link is strongly dependent on the performance of the other links, we cannot ignore the fact that organizations are not just a pile of different links. They should be regarded as chains.
Or at least a grid.
Yes, but you see, every grid can be viewed as composed of several independent chains. The more complex the organization, the more interdependencies between the various links, the smaller number of independent chains it's composed of.
If you say so, but that's not so important. The important thing is you've just proven that any organization should be viewed as a chain. I can take it from here. Since the strength of the chain is determined by the weakest link, then the first step to improve an organization must be to identify the weakest link.
Or links. Remember, an organization may be comprised of several independent chains.
Yes, but as you said, the complexity of our organizations almost guarantees that there are not many of them. Fine, Alex. What do we do about the measurements?
Measurements? Where did they come from?
Didn't we agree yesterday that the distorted measurements are the biggest constraint of the division?
Bob Donovan is right. Lou certainly has a fixation on measurements. They are definitely a big problem, but I'm not convinced that they are the constraint.
You're not?
No, I'm not. Do you think that the fact that most of our products are already outdated in comparison to what the competition is offering is not a major problem? Don't you realize that the attitude in engineering, claiming that the basic rule of nature is that a project never finishes on time, is an even bigger problem? And what about marketing? Have you seen any marketing plan that has any chance of turning the situation around?
No. As a matter of fact, everything that I've seen of long-term planning should be more appropriately categorized under long-term bullshitting.
I'm on a roll. Today, asking me about problems is like opening a dam. Wait, Lou, I haven't finished. What about the mentality that's so prevalent in headquarters, the mentality of cover your ass? Haven't you noticed that whenever we asked about something that doesn't go so well, everyone almost automatically started to blame everybody else?
How could I not notice? Okay, Alex, I get your point. There are major problems all over. It seems that in our division there is a whole herd of constraints, not just a few.
I still claim that there are only few constraints. Our division is too complex to have more than a very few independent chains. Lou, don't you realize that everything we mentioned so far is closely connected? The lack of sensible long-term strategy, the measurement issues, the lag in product design, the long lead times in production, the general attitude of passing the ball, of apathy, they're all connected. We must put our finger on the core problem, on the root that causes them all. That's what actually is meant by identify the constraint. It's not prioritizing the bad effects. It's identifying what caused them all.
How are we going to do that? How are we going to identify the divisional constraint?
I don't know. But if we succeeded in doing it here, in our plant, it must be possible to do in the division.
I don't think so. Here we were lucky. We were dealing with physical constraints, with bottlenecks. That's easy. But at the divisional level, we'll have to deal with measurements, with policies, with procedures. Many of them are cast already into behavioral patterns.
I don't see the difference. Here, we had to deal with all the above. Come to think about it, even here, the constraints were never the machines. Yes, we called and still call the oven and the NCX-10 bottlenecks. But if they were true bottlenecks, how come we succeeded to squeeze almost twice as much out of them as before? How come we increased throughput so much without buying more capacity?
But we changed almost every aspect of how to operate them and how we operate everything around them.
That's exactly my point. What aspect of operation did we change? The measurements, the policies, the procedures. Many of them were cast into behavioral patterns. Lou, don't you see? The real constraints, even in our plant, were not the machines. They were the policies.
Yes, I do see, but still there are differences.
What differences? Name one.
Alex, what's the use of pushing me into a corner? Don't you see that there must be major differences? If there weren't, how come we don't even have a clue of what the nature of the divisional constraints is?
That stops me dead. Sorry, you're right. You know, Lou, maybe we were lucky here. We had physical constraints that helped us to focus our attention, to zoom in on the real policy constraint. That isn't the case in the division. Over there, we have excess capacity going through our ears. We have excess engineering resources that we succeeded so brilliantly in wasting. I'm sure that there is no lack of markets. We simply don't know how to put our act together to capitalize on what we have.
That brings us to the real question. How does one go about identifying the system's constraint? How can we zoom in on the most devastating erroneous policies? Or to use your term, how does one go about identifying the core problem, the one that is responsible for the existence of so many undesirable effects?
Yes, that's the question, no doubt. What's written here on the board is still valid. Identifying the system's constraint is the first step. What we now understand is that it also translates into a mandatory demand for a technique by which to do it. Lou, that's it! We found it! Here it is! Here is the answer to Jonah's question. I'm going to call him right now. You can imagine my first sentence. Jonah, I want you to teach me how to identify the core problem.
Alex, I think that it might be a little premature.
Why? Do you have any doubt that this is what I must learn first?
No, on that I'm quite convinced. I just think that maybe you should ask for more. Knowing the core problem exactly might be far from sufficient.
You are right again. It's just that I was looking for the answer for so long.
I understand. Believe me, I understand.
Okay, Lou. What else do you think I should ask Jonah to teach me?
I don't know. But if the five steps are valid, maybe what you should ask for are the techniques required to enable us to carry those steps out. We already found the need for one technique. Why don't we continue to examine the other four steps?
Good idea. Let's proceed. The second step is decide how to exploit the system's constraints. That doesn't make any sense to me. What is the point in trying to exploit an erroneous policy?
It makes sense only if the constraint is physical. But since we do deal with policy constraints, I guess we better move to the next one.
Subordinate everything else to the above decision. Same reservation. If the constraint is not physical, this step is meaningless. The fourth step is elevate the system's constraints. What are we going to do with this one?
What's the problem? If we identify an erroneous policy, we should elevate it. We should change the policy.
How lovely. You make it sound so simple. Change the policy. To what? Is it so simple to find a suitable replacement? Maybe for you, Lou. Not for me.
Oh, for me neither. I know that cost accounting is erroneous, but that doesn't mean I've completely figured out what to replace it with. Alex, how does one go about correcting an erroneous measurement or any other policy?
First, I think that you need the light bulb idea, the breakthrough. The management techniques that Jonah talks about must include the ability to trigger such ideas. Otherwise, those techniques can't be used by mere mortals. You know, Lou, Julie predicted that as I come to it, I'll recognize that we are not dealing here just with techniques, but actually with thinking processes.
It started to look like it, but triggering breakthrough ideas by itself is not enough. An even bigger obstacle is to verify that this idea really solves all the resulting bad effects.
Without creating new ones.
Is it possible at all?
It must be, if we want to plan rather than just react. Yes, Lou, must be possible. Look what happened to us with our solution of getting more sales. As a direct result of the French order, we threw the plant into a very unpleasant 2 weeks, and we killed, or at least delayed, a good marketing campaign. If we just thought systematically before we implemented it, rather than after the fact, we could have prevented many problems. Don't tell me that it was impossible. All the facts were known to us. We simply didn't have a thinking process that could force and guide us to examine it early in the game.
What do we change to?
Pardon me?
If the first thinking process should lead us to answer the question, what to change, the second thinking process should lead us to answer the question, what to change to. Well, I can already see the need for a third thinking process.
Yes, so can I. How to cause the change? Look at the fifth step. With the amount of inertia that we can expect in the division, the last one is probably the most important.
So it seems.
Do you understand what we are asking for? We are asking for the most fundamental things, and at the same time, we are asking for the world.
I've lost you.
What are we asking for? For the ability to answer three simple questions. What to change? What to change to? And how to cause the change? Basically, what we are asking for is the most fundamental abilities one would expect from a manager. Think about it. If a manager doesn't know how to answer those three questions, is he or she entitled to be called manager? At the same time, can you imagine what the meaning is to being able to hone in on the core problem, even in a very complex environment? To be able to construct and check solutions that really solve all negative effects without creating new ones. And above all, to cause such a major change smoothly without creating resistance, but the opposite, enthusiasm. Can you imagine having such abilities?
Alex, that is what you have done. That's exactly what you have done in our plan.
Yes and no. Yes, that's what we've done. No, Lou, without Jonah's guidance, all of us would be looking for new jobs today.
Now I understand why he refused to continue advising us. Jonah said it to me in the clearest way. We should learn to be able to do it without any external help. I must learn these thinking processes. Only then will I know that I'm doing my job.
We should and can be our own Jonas.
Then this reserved person surprises me. He stands up and puts his arm around my shoulder.
Alex, I'm proud to work for you.
Five focusing steps. 1. Identify the system's constraint. 2. Decide how to exploit the system's constraint. 3. Subordinate everything else to the above decisions. 4. Elevate the system's constraint. 5. If in the previous steps a constraint has been broken, go back to step 1, but do not allow inertia to cause a system constraint. Standing on the shoulders of giants. Production concepts versus production applications. The Hitachi tool engineering example. One of Ellie Goldratt's convictions was that the goal of an individual or an organization should not be defined in absolute terms. A good definition of a goal is one that sets us on a path of ongoing improvement. Pursuing such a goal necessitates more than one breakthrough. In fact, it requires many. To be in a position to identify these breakthroughs, we should have a deep understanding of the underlying rules of our environment. 25 years after writing The Goal, Dr. Goldratt wrote Standing on the Shoulders of Giants. In this article, he provided the underlying rules of operations. This article is included here in his memory. Introduction. It's easy to trace the popularity of lean production to Toyota's success. Toyota's success was undeniable. Toyota manufactured as many cars as the traditional leader, GM, and did it while making profits. Between 2003 and 2008, Toyota's average net profit over sales was 70% higher than the industry average, while GM was losing money. The success of Toyota is fully attributed to the Toyota Production System, TPS. At least, this is the conviction of Toyota's management. The stated number one challenge of Toyota is to pass TPS on as the company's DNA to the next generation. Given that Toyota is the flagship of Japan's industry, one should expect that lean would be widely implemented in Japan. Surprisingly, this is not the case. It is commonly known in Japan that less than 20% of the manufacturers have implemented lean. How come? It is not because they did not try to implement it. Many companies in Japan put serious efforts into trying to implement lean, but failed. One such company is Hitachi Tool Engineering. Their inability to implement lean cannot be explained by a lack of serious efforts. This company repeatedly tried to implement lean, but the deterioration in production performance forced them to go back to the more traditional ways of managing production. Likewise, the fact that most of Japanese industry did not implement lean cannot be attributed to a lack of sufficient knowledge. Toyota was more than generous in sharing their knowledge. This company put all the TPS knowledge in the public domain and even went as far as inviting their direct competitors to visit their plants. Hitachi, like so many other companies, was using the available knowledge and was not shy about hiring the help of the best experts available. There is an explanation to these companies' failure to implement lean. An explanation that is apparent to any objective observer of a company like Hitachi Tool Engineering. The failure is due to the fundamental difference in the production environments. When Taiichi Ono developed TPS, he didn't do it in the abstract. He developed it for his company. It's no wonder that the powerful application that Ono developed might not work in fundamentally different production environments. But that doesn't mean that Ono's work cannot be extremely valuable for other environments. The genius of Ono is fully revealed when we realized that he faced the exact same situation. At that time, the production system that revolutionized production was the flow line method that Henry Ford developed. Ford's method was already used not only for almost all vehicle assembly, but also in very different industries like beverages and ammunition. Also at that time, it was already accepted that flow lines can and must be implemented only in environments where the required quantities justify dedication of equipment to a single product. Whenever production quantities were not big enough, no one contemplated the possibility of using lines, no one except for Ono. Ono realized that the concepts that underlie Ford's system are generic, that his application is restricted to certain types of environments, but the concepts are universal. Ono had the clear vision to start from the concepts, the genius to design an application that's suitable for Toyota's environment, where it is not feasible to dedicate equipment to the production of a component, and the tenacity to overcome the huge obstacles standing in the way of implementing such an application. The result is TPS. Rather than refraining from using the right concepts, or even worse, trying to force the application in environments that are apparently too different, we should follow in Ono's footsteps. In this paper, we'll present the fundamental concepts of flow, the concepts that Lean is based upon, a generic application of these concepts that can be used in a much wider spectrum of environments, and the impressive results Hitachi Tool Engineering achieved with this broader application. Historical perspective. The manufacturing industry has been shaped by two great thinkers, Henry Ford and Taiichi Ono. Ford revolutionized mass production by introducing the flow lines. Ono took Ford's ideas to the next level in his TPS, a system that forced the entire industry to change its grasp of inventory from an asset to a liability. Ford's starting point was that the key for effective production is to concentrate on improving the overall flow of products through the operations. His efforts to improve flow were so successful that by 1926, the lead time from mining the iron ore to having a completed car composed of more than 5,000 parts on the train ready for delivery was 81 hours. 80 years later, no car manufacturer in the world has been able to achieve or even come close to such a short lead time. Flow means that inventories in the operation are moving. When inventory is not moving, inventory accumulates. Accumulation of inventory takes up space. Therefore, an intuitive way to achieve better flow is to limit the space allowed for inventory to accumulate. To achieve better flow, Ford limited the space allotted for work in process between each two work centers. That is the essence of the flow lines, as can be verified by the fact that the first flow lines didn't have any mechanical means, like conveyors, to move inventory from one work center to another. The daring nature of Ford's method is revealed when one realizes that a direct consequence of limiting the space is that when the allotted space is full, the workers feeding it must stop producing. Therefore, in order to achieve flow, Ford had to abolish local efficiencies. In other words, flow lines are flying in the face of conventional wisdom. The convention that, to be effective, every worker and every work center have to be busy 100% of the time. One might think that preventing resources from working continuously will decrease throughput, output of the operation. That undesirable effect might have been the result if Ford would have been satisfied with just limiting the space. But there is another effect that stems from restricting the accumulation of inventory. It makes it very visible to spot the real problems that jeopardize the flow. When one work center in a line stops producing for more than a short while, soon the whole line stops. Ford took advantage of the resulting clear visibility to better balance the flow by addressing and eliminating the apparent stoppages. The end result of abolishing local efficiencies and balancing the flow is a substantial increase in throughput. Henry Ford achieved the highest throughput per worker of any car manufacturing company of his time. In summary, Ford's flow lines are based on the following four concepts. 1. Improving flow, or equivalently lead time, is a primary objective of operations. 2. This primary objective should be translated into a practical mechanism that guides the operation when not to produce, prevents overproduction. 3. Local efficiencies must be abolished. 4. A focusing process to balance flow must be in place. Like Ford, Ono's primary objective was improving flow, decreasing lead time, as indicated in his response to the question about what Toyota is doing. All we are doing is looking at the timeline from the moment the customer gives us an order to the point when we collect the cash, and we are reducing that timeline. Ono faced an almost insurmountable obstacle when he came to apply the second concept. When the demand for a single product is high, dedicating a line to producing each component, as Ford did, is justified. However, at that time in Japan, the market demand was for small quantities of a variety of cars. Therefore, Ono could not dedicate lines at Toyota. As we already said, all other industries that faced this situation simply did not contemplate using lines. Ono, however, was toying with the idea of using lines when the equipment is not dedicated, when each work center is producing a variety of components. The problem was that, in this case, using the mechanism of limited space would lead to gridlocks. Not all components are available for assembly. Assembly cannot work while the allotted space is already full. Feeding lines are prevented from working. Ono writes that he realized the solution when he heard about supermarkets, much before he actually saw a supermarket during his visit to the U.S. in 1956. He realized that both supermarkets and the feeding lines at Toyota needed to manage a large variety of products. In the supermarkets, products were not jam-packing the aisles. Rather, most merchandise was held in the backroom storage. In the store itself, each product was allocated a limited shelf space. Only after a product was taken by a shopper was replenishment from the backroom storage triggered to refill that product's allotted shelf space. What Ono envisioned is the mechanism that would enable him to guide Toyota's operation when not to produce. Rather than using a single limited space between work centers to restrict work-in-process production, he had to limit the amount allowed to accumulate of each component specifically. Based on that realization, Ono designed the Kanban system. The Kanban system has been described in numerous articles and books. In this article, I'll describe just the essence to show how true Ono was to the fundamental concepts. Between each two work centers, and for each component separately, the accumulation of inventory is limited by setting a certain number of containers and the number of units per container. These containers, like every container in every industry, also contain the relevant paperwork. But one page of the paperwork, usually a card, Kanban in Japanese, a page that specifies only the component code name and the number of units per container, is treated in an unconventional way. When the succeeding work center withdraws a container for further processing, that card is not moved with the container. Rather, it is passed back to the preceding work center. This is the notification to that work center that a container was withdrawn, that the allotted inventory is not full. Only in that case is the preceding work center allowed to produce one container of parts specified by the card. In essence, the Kanban system directs each work center when and what to produce, but more importantly, it directs when not to produce. No card, no production. The Kanban system is the practical mechanism that guides the operation when not to produce, prevents overproduction. Ono succeeded to expand Ford's concepts by changing the base of the mechanism from space to inventory. Adhering to the flow concept mandates the abolishment of local efficiencies. Ono addressed this issue again and again in his books, stressing that there's no point in encouraging people to produce if the products are not needed in the very short term. This emphasis is probably the reason that outside Toyota, TPS first became known as just-in-time production. Once the Kanban system, the system that guides the operation when not to produce, was implemented on the shop floor, the immediate reduction in throughput mandated a mammoth effort to balance the flow. The challenge that Ono faced was orders of magnitude bigger than the one Ford faced. To realize how big the challenge was, it's enough to highlight just one aspect out of the many. Unlike in dedicated line environments, Ono's system forced a work center to frequently switch from producing one component to another. For most work centers, every such switch necessitates spending time to do the required setup. Since the containers, by design, called for a relatively small number of parts, the production batches that they dictated were, many times, ridiculously smaller relative to the setup required. Initially, for many work centers, the time required for setups was more than the time required for production, resulting in a significant drop in throughput. It's no wonder that Ono faced enormous resistance, so much so that Ono wrote that his system was referred to as the abominable Ono system from the late 1940s to the early 1960s. Ono and his superiors certainly had an extraordinary determination and vision to continue to push for the implementation of a system that, for any person who looked at it from a local perspective, as most shop personnel must have, simply didn't make sense. Ono had to pave a new way to overcome the setup obstacle. At the time, and until TPS became famous worldwide, the traditional way to deal with setups was to increase the batch size. Economical batch quantity was the popular name on which thousands of articles were written. Ono ignored all that body of knowledge, since yielding to using economical quantities would have doomed his quest to reduce the lead times. Rather, he insisted that the setups required are not cast in stone, that the processes can be modified to drastically reduce the setup time required. He led the efforts to develop and implement setup reduction techniques that eventually reduced all setup times in Toyota to be at most just a few minutes. It's no wonder that lean is now strongly associated with small batches and setup reduction techniques. But the need to balance the flow necessitated much more than just dealing with the setup obstacle. The fact that most work centers were not dedicated to a single component made it almost impossible to spot by direct observation the real problems which jeopardized the flow. Ono was fully aware that there were too many things that could be improved, that without a way to focus the process improvement efforts, it would take too long to balance the flow. The Kanban system provided him such a way. The rocks and water analogy of lean is useful for understanding how this is done. The water level corresponds to the inventory level, while the rocks are the problems disturbing the flow. There are many rocks at the bottom of the river, and it takes time and effort to remove them. The question is which rocks are important to remove. The answer is given by reducing the water level. Those rocks which emerge above the water are the ones that should be removed. At the initiation of the Kanban system, to achieve reasonable throughput, Ono had to start with many containers, each holding a non-negligible quantity of a particular part. Gradually, Ono reduced the number of containers and then the quantities in each container. If the flow was not noticeably disturbed, then the reduction of the number of containers and quantities per container continued. When the flow was disturbed, the five whys method was used to pinpoint the root cause. It had to be fixed before the quantities could be further reduced. It took time, but the end result was a remarkable improvement in productivity. It should be noted that even though, in the last 20 years, every other car company has implemented one version or another of the Toyota system and reaped major benefits, the productivity of Toyota is unmatched by any other car company. This fact points to the importance of making the correct choice of the process that focuses the local improvement efforts. Unfortunately, the improvement efforts of other companies are misguided, since they're aimed at achieving cost savings rather than being totally focused on improving the flow. Ono did not invest so much effort in reducing the setup times in order to gain some cost savings. If saving cost would have been his target, he would not have wasted the time saved by further reducing the batches and therefore doing much more setups. Ono did not try to reduce the number of defective parts in order to save some trivial costs. He did it to eliminate the major disruptions to flow that result from having a defective part. Ono did not even try to squeeze better prices from Toyota suppliers or to cut the payroll of Toyota, the two main elements of cost. Rather, he put all his energy into improving the flow. What is obliterating the picture is that the end result of focusing on flow and ignoring local cost considerations is a much lower cost per unit. Exactly like the end result of abolishing local efficiencies resulting in much higher efficiency of the labor force. If it looks strange, it's because managers have not yet internalized the conceptual difference in guiding operations to concentrate on improving throughput rather than concentrating on reducing costs. One of the ramifications of concentrating on cost reduction is that almost all initiatives to foster a process of ongoing improvement quickly reach a point of diminishing returns, and as a result, many deteriorate to lip service. But that issue is too broad and too important to be squeezed into this article. In summary, both Ford and Ono followed four concepts. From now on, we'll refer to them as the concepts of flow. 1. Improving flow, or equivalently, lead time, is a primary objective of operations. 2. This primary objective should be translated into a practical mechanism that guides the operation when not to produce, prevents overproduction. Ford used space, Ono used inventory. 3. Local efficiencies must be abolished. 4. A focusing process to balance flow must be in place. Ford used direct observation. Ono used the gradual reduction of the number of containers and then gradual reduction of parts per container. The boundaries of TPS. Ono's approach in developing lean demonstrates an important idea. There's a difference between an application and the fundamental concepts on which the application is based. The fundamental concepts are generic. The application is the translation of the concepts for a specific environment. As we've already seen, the translation is not trivial and necessitates a number of solution elements. What we have to bear in mind is that the application makes assumptions, sometimes hidden assumptions, about the environment. We should not expect an application to work in environments for which its assumptions are not valid. We can save a lot of effort and frustration if we take the time to explicitly articulate these assumptions. The most demanding assumption that TPS makes about the production environment is that it is a stable environment, and it demands stability in three different aspects. The first aspect is revealed once we pay attention to the fact that even when an appropriate environment is chosen and the best experts are supervising the implementation, it takes considerable time to implement lean. Liker points out, in the Toyota way, that lean implementations led by the Toyota Supplier Support Center, TSSC, the organization Toyota created to teach U.S. companies TPS, take a minimum of 6 to 9 months per production line. This is not a surprise to anybody who's aware of the number of disruptions to flow that exist in almost any production environment and the sensitivity of the Kanban system once it starts to reach its target of low inventory. Since the Kanban system takes time to implement, its assumption is that the environment is relatively stable, that the processes and the products do not change significantly for a considerable length of time. Toyota enjoys a relatively stable environment. The car industry allows changes only once a year, a model year change, and usually from one year to another, the vast majority of the components are the same. That is not the case for many other industries. For example, in major sections of the electronics industry, the lifespan of most products is shorter than 6 months. To some extent, instability of products and processes exists in most other industries. For example, Hitachi Tool Engineering is producing cutting tools, a relatively stable type of product, but fierce competition forces this company to launch new cutting tools that require new technology every 6 months. It is a Sisyphean task to implement lean in such an environment. A second aspect of the stability required by TPS is stability in demand over time per product. Suppose that the lead time to produce a certain product is 2 weeks, but the demand for that product is sporadic. On average, there's just one order per quarter for that product. Currently, this product contributes to the work in process only during 2 weeks in a quarter. The rest of the time, it's not present on the shop floor. But that will not be the case under Lean, which mandates permanently holding containers for each product between each two work centers. Hitachi Tool Engineering is producing over 20,000 different SKUs. For most SKUs, the demand is sporadic. The necessity to permanently hold, for each SKU, inventory between each two work centers would lead, in the Hitachi case, to holding considerably more work-in-process inventory than what they hold today. This is apparently not a suitable environment for Ono's application. But the most demanding aspect of the stability required by TPS is stability in total load placed by the orders on the various types of resources. Suppose that, like in most companies, the orders are not uniform throughout. It is very likely that the load placed this week on a particular work center is considerably lower than its capacity, while next week the load is higher than its capacity. In this very common case, the Kanban system, that is, preventing build ahead, preventing producing ahead of time, will lead to missed due dates in the second week. Toyota's orders are relatively stable, and nevertheless, Toyota had to establish a mode of receiving orders and promising deliveries that restricts the mix change from 1 month to another. Most companies are not able to enforce such favorable conditions on their clients. It's important to note that the required stability is beyond the power of production to improve. All three aspects of stability have to do with the way the company designs and sells its products and not with the way it produces them. Unfortunately, the majority of companies suffer from at least one aspect of instability, if not from all three. The above doesn't mean that, for environments in which the assumptions of Lean are not valid, fragments of Lean cannot be used. For example, U-cells can be helpful in many environments, and setup reduction techniques can be used in almost every environment. But it does mean that, in such environments, one should not expect to get the same magnitude of results that Toyota achieves, results that elevate that company into what it currently is. Using some specific techniques of Lean, being satisfied with some cost-saving programs, shouldn't be considered as implementing Lean. The importance of flow in relatively unstable environments. Ford and Ono opened our eyes to the fact that better flow, reducing lead time, leads to much more effective operations. They have demonstrated it in stable environments, but what is the impact of improved flow on relatively unstable environments? The first aspect of instability is instability due to short product life. When the product's life is short, overproduction can become obsolescence. Moreover, since the lifetime is short, long production lead times lead to missing the market demand. For example, suppose that the lifetime of a product is about 6 months, and the production lead time of that product is 2 months. The long production lead time results in lost sales, not because the demand is not there, but because, for a significant portion of the market life, production cannot satisfy the demand. The second aspect of instability is instability in demand over time per product. The common practice in environments that have a large number of SKUs that are subject to sporadic demand is to reduce the hassle by trying to satisfy this demand from stock. The disadvantage of this practice is high finished goods inventories that turn extremely slowly, coupled with high levels of shortages. A production system that's capable of organizing the shop floor to the extent that much better flow is achieved has a drastic impact on these environments. Environments that suffer from the third aspect of instability, instability in the overall load, are the ones that can gain the most from much better flow. The temporary overloads on the various resources cause these companies to usually have relatively poor due date performance, less than 90%, and as a result, they're inclined to add more capacity. Experience shows that when such companies succeed in substantially improving flow, not only do their due dates reach the high 90s, but excess capacity, as high as 50%, is revealed. Ono demonstrated that the concepts Ford introduced are not restricted to